Welcome to the University of Michigan Press Podcast, a monthly show featuring interviews with University of Michigan Press authors.
The election of Barack Obama to the presidency marks the conclusive end to the Reagan era, writes John Kenneth White in Barack Obama's America. Reagan symbolized a 1950s and 60s America, largely white and suburban, with married couples and kids at home who attended church more often than not. The demographics, however, have shifted. Marriage is at an all-time low. Cohabitation has increased from 500,000 couples in 1960 to more than 5 million in 2000 to even more this year. Gay marriages and civil unions are redefining what it means to be a family, and organized religions are suffering, even as Americans continue to think of themselves as a religious people. Here to talk with us about his new book, Barack Obama's America, How New Conceptions of Race, Family, and Religion Ended the Reagan Era, is John Kenneth White. White is professor of politics at the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C. So, do you think that Barack Obama's election was a reflection of change in American attitudes or more a change in the type of people who make up the country?
I think it's both. If you look at this country 30 years ago, you could describe the majority of the American electorate as being un-young, un-poor, and un-black. Or, if you look at it another way, we were white, middle-aged, middle-income. We went to church weekly, and most of us lived in the suburbs. And that world is very well known to those of us, like myself, that were born in the 1950s and grew up in that world. So we watch programs like The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet or Leave It to Beaver or Father Knows Best, or even in the 80s, The Cosby Show. That country that I grew up in has now come to an end and is rapidly coming to an end. So we know that by the middle of this century, whites are going to be a minority of the entire American electorate. We know that in two decades, Hispanics will be about a third of the American electorate. And what's happening is that the face of America is changing from white into some form of beige or bronze. People like Tiger Woods identify with this century and are emblematic of this new century. And as we go forward, race really does become kind of a slippery slope. What's white? What's black? What about people of mixed race, of which we have a growing number of people in this country? So just from the racial standpoint, the country has changed dramatically, and Obama's election as the first African-American president is certainly reflective of that change in race. But we've also had a change in the nature of the American family, a big change. Again, in the 1950s, the family really consisted of a mom, dad, and kids. That description of the family is now less than a third of the American electorate, or, again, in the 1970s, about three-quarters of the American electorate belonged to families like the one I just described, mom, dad, kids. That's down now to a quarter of the American electorate. We have high rates of divorce, but that's been actually pretty stable over the last couple of decades. What's changed is we have more cohabitation. We have more. We have certainly more children born out of wedlock. And the definition of family has changed so dramatically. So only about a third of Americans say to pollsters, when I hear the word family, that means to me, mom, dad, kids. The number one response today is love. And families can be described in all kinds of ways. In fact, a very high description is families headed by grandparents, or where grandparents play a pivotal role. And Barack Obama reflects both this change in race, but also change in the definition of family. We know his family story very well. Born to a single mother, raised by that single mother and grandparents. And that is so important because transforming presidents like Obama really reflect the stories of their time. Ronald Reagan reflected the story of his time. He was divorced, but he had a very stable second marriage. He had two children from that marriage. He didn't always get along with those kids very well, but that, too, was emblematic of the 1960s and 70s. Obama's story is emblematic, I think, for our time. And so the 2008 election brought all of these things together. It really represents a very significant change in our attitudes. You see, it's a change in demography, but it's also, I think, a change in philosophy. Because Reagan complained that government was the problem, that it didn't work. What happened in 2008, I think, is that we wanted a government that did work. And so the Reagan agenda of less taxation, less government, I think that's coming to an end as well. And I also think that as this demographic shift goes forward, the so-called culture wars that revolved around issues like abortion and divorce and gay rights and so forth, I think on a number of these issues, we're coming to a kind of consensus. So 2008, I think, is not a run-of-the-mill election. It is a pivotal election that I think is going to say a lot about our future.
So what would you consider to be the most important demographic trends in this country, as reflected by the election?
Well, I think the most important demographic trend is in this area of race. If you look at the 2008 election, the total electorate, whites comprised 74% of that electorate. And they went for John McCain, by the way, 55-43. But that 74% total is the lowest ever since we've done exit polls, going back to the 1970s. And that 74% is probably going to be less in 2012, less in 2016. And that is just, again, a reflection of the change in the nation's demography. Here's the flip side. African-American participation rose to levels equivalent to whites in 2008. That's not terribly surprising, given that Obama is the first African-American candidate of a major party. But it does reflect a small uptick, if you will, in the African-American population, although that's been pretty stable. Hispanics are a big story. In 1980, they were 1% of the electorate. In 2008, they were 9% of the electorate, and that percentage is increasing. If you look at the African-American vote in 2008, Obama won 95% of that vote. Among Hispanics, he won 66% of that vote. And so that is, I think, just hugely important. If you look at that un-young, un-poor, un-black, that old real majority of the 1970s, McCain won those sorts of demographics pretty convincingly, and so did George W. Bush. But in 2000, that was only 48% of the total vote. It was only 51% in 2004, thanks to 9/11, and was only 46% in 2008. So that change demography has really sort of upended our understanding about how politics works in this country. What are the major groups that we need to appeal to? We used to think of the center, and we would talk about the center in demographic terms as being white, middle-aged, middle-income, suburban, so forth. That's not to say that's unimportant, but their importance is declining, and there are so many changes in the electorate that our old ways of understanding what the electorate is, who the typical voter is, needs significant revision, and that's what this book hopes to accomplish.
So let's talk about religion. What types of religious changes are we seeing, and what kind of impact did that have?
Well, so far, we've talked about really two big revolutions in race and family, but we've got another one ongoing in religion. And this is kind of a complicated revolution because I think people on either side tend to demagogue it. In other words, the country is not becoming less religious. We are still a very religious country. Overwhelming numbers of Americans believe in God, believe in a heaven, believe there is a hell, believe in the power of prayer. It is the location of religion that has shifted, and that is away from the institution, from the church, from a building per se. It is certainly more interior, praying at home, considering myself to be a religious person. And that doesn't necessarily involve going to church. Church attendance is down in the country, and we've seen that decline over a number of decades. And yet, we have majorities of Americans say you can be a religious, a moral person, a Christian, without going to church. That change in location has also coincided with a huge rise in tolerance. We're not a doctrinaire country. There is something to be said, as Alan Wolf describes it, about the Heinz 57 church. And the line I like best, actually, is from David Brooks, in which he described Americans not as being summoned to a last judgment, but to a last discussion with the Almighty, that Americans would much prefer the last discussion as opposed to the last judgment. In that environment, then, the religions that are thriving in the country are those that don't emphasize rules per se. That is, you must attend church, you must abstain from eating meat on Friday, you must not do this or that. The ones that are thriving, I think, are the ones that are say, this is why you need to belong to a church. This is what can contribute to one's own personal or spiritual growth. Rick Warren, the mega pastor, did a really smart thing before he actually formed his church, and that is he went out and talked to people about why they went to whether they went to church or not. If they didn't go, why didn't they go? What were they looking for? What were their needs? How could their needs be met? So he didn't just build a building. He went out and found out what people wanted. And what they wanted, they did want spiritual growth. They didn't want long sermons. They wanted to belong to a community and have a sense of belonging. They liked the idea of one-stop shopping so that their kids could be educated there if need be. They could shop there. They could belong to something larger than themselves. That's the thing I think that stood out in his survey. And then when he formed his Saddleback Community Church in California, it was hugely successful. So to sum up, I think that the location of religion has changed from the building to interior. I think that mega churches are on the rise in part because they too are responding to this shift in the sense that they are not flouting rules but saying here's why we need to belong, and I think it's the expression of religion that is shifting, and Obama too reflects that in just his own spiritual journey. It's a very fascinating story because one of the arguments he makes in his autobiography is that he searched for a Christian religion. His mother didn't belong to a Christian faith. And one of the reasons that he said he wanted to do that is that he knew that if he did not, he would always be apart from his fellow Americans. And then, as you know, when he became president, he actually took some time before joining a church, and that, too, is very, very typical of Americans. So it's not a situation where people say, my father or mother was of this faith, I will remain in that faith. For so many Americans, this has become a spiritual journey with lots of very different choices that people are making.
So tell us, what type of research sources did you use for the book?
Well, you know, I've written 5 books altogether, and Barack Obama's America is the 5th one. And in all my books, I tell stories. I did a book on the Cold War, and I told a story about the Cold War, which was also somewhat about my own story. But I think what makes this book different is that it's somewhat autobiographical, particularly in the beginning, because, as I said earlier, I lived through the 1950s and 60s. I lived through that kind of America that produced Dwight Eisenhower, Richard Nixon, and Ronald Reagan. When I was studying politics, both in college and in my graduate work, it was commonly understood that that was really sort of our understanding. Now I'm married. I have a 12-year-old daughter. She has gone to elementary school in our suburban Maryland community, and I was immediately struck by the fact that in this suburban school, she was a racial minority. That didn't really faze her or strike her, by the way, in any particular way, because that's the world in which she is going to live in this century. And so I think that while I used a number of different books and looked at a lot of census data and newspaper articles, in telling the story, I also found it helpful to, in some ways, in a small way, tell my own story. And in some ways, that's what made the book quite different. There is a bibliography online where people can go to and see the myriad of resources that I used.
So moving forward, what do you think these changes mean for politicians?
Well, I think they mean an awful lot. Start with the Democratic Party. These new demographics really work very well for the Democratic Party. That is a country that is less white, with many different types of families, that isn't necessarily attending church on a weekly basis. There's an old saying that demography is destiny. And that saying, I believe, is fundamentally true. Again, if you go back to that old real majority, I'm young, I'm poor, and I'm black, that worked great for the Republicans. That was their constituency. That's the America that elected Eisenhower and Nixon and Reagan and even the first George Bush. That has all changed. Again, as we become less white, as we have many different religious practices, many different types of families, and also a country that is increasingly accepting of and tolerant of homosexuals, that's a environment in which the Democratic Party can prosper. The Republicans, I think, at one level understand this shift, but in another way, they're going through a period of mourning and denial. There's a mourning for the glory days of Ronald Reagan, but Ronald Reagan is dead. Ronald Reagan has not been in office for 2 decades. And there hasn't been yet, among the Republicans, I think, a serious attempt to address these demographic deficiencies. We had 31 out of 40 Republicans vote against Sonia Sotomayor to the Supreme Court. We will deal with immigration reform sometime this year or next, and they may be very reluctant to support that. So how do they outreach to Hispanics? They did put Michael Steele in as chair of the RNC, which I think was a tacit admission that that the demography had changed and they better do something. But Steele's outreach to African Americans, to minorities, I think has been awkward, and I think that's charitably put. So the Republicans have the greater challenge, I think, in this whole environment. But there's another thing too. Demography is important, but it's not enough by itself. You have to have accomplishments and success in government. And Reagan was, I think, a successful president in that he did begin to think about have the country think about reducing the size of government, reducing the size of taxation. That became the agenda. And he was great at helping people to restore confidence in the country and its government and the presidency and its institutions generally. And the country desperately needed that. The Reagan era, though, is over. Americans aren't on a default setting where they're talking about less taxes or less government. I think, again, they want government that works. And what's really hurt the Republicans is having an unsuccessful president in the person of George W. Bush, who is the modern-day Hoover. And parties, whether it's the Republicans after Hoover or go back earlier, the Democrats after James Buchanan, or more recently, the Democrats after Jimmy Carter, these are all disappointing presidencies. And parties have to deal with disappointing presidencies and say why the future under them is going to be different. So I think the challenge is great for Democrats because Obama has to be successful. People have to judge his governance as making a difference. And the demography, of course, is favoring him, so the wind is at his back, so to speak. But I think the Republicans have an even greater challenge. They have a demographic challenge. How do they appeal to this new America? And they have a philosophical challenge of how do they reorient their conservative approach to governance in this new century, and particularly following the disappointing presidency of George W. Bush. For the moment, I think the Republicans can make some short-term gains thanks to some unpopular Democratic candidates, and we may see that in 2009, 2010. We may also see them make some gains because the Democrats may overreach. But I think their long-term future really does depend how they adapt to what has become Barack Obama's America.
This is really fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us, Professor White.
You're welcome.
We have been speaking with John Kenneth White, author of Barack Obama's America, How New Conceptions of Race, Family, and Religion Ended the Reagan Era. To learn more about our books, please visit us on the web at press.umich.edu. This podcast has been brought to you by the University of Michigan Press, copyright 2008. All rights reserved.